Support comes from the Arizona Inn, a Four Diamond, family-owned historic resort hotel and restaurant on Elm Street near the U of A. Information is at arizonainn.com.
Hello, everyone. I'm Jim Dinsel, the host of Zona Politics. Today, we are going to be talking with Jim Small, the editor-in-chief at the Arizona Mirror, a new online publication website that is celebrating its first birthday. So happy birthday to the Arizona Mirror. And Jim, talk a little bit about what the Arizona Mirror is all about and what you've been doing for the last year.
Yeah, so we are a nonprofit newsroom. We've opened a year ago, launched at the end of September in 2018, right in the middle of the election season. You know, really, our mission is to cover the statehouse, cover state government, cover public policy. And you know, the way we've chosen to approach it is to try to do it differently than most other media outlets do. You know, I think that there's a tendency to write stories about government that are really wonky and insidery, and almost ultimately are written for people who are already following what's happening in the government. And that's great for the people that are following the government, but that doesn't do a whole lot to help get other people involved, people engaged in the government, people to understand what's happening in their government and why it's important to their lives and why it's important to their community and their neighbors and their friends and their family. So we've got, you know, an approach that really is trying to cover the Capitol from the outside in instead of from the inside out. I've really, you know, stressed to my reporters that the most important way to cover state government and to cover government of any kind is to not be at the government buildings, is to go away, go into the community, go talk to the people who are affected, go find the folks who are helped or hurt or are happy or angry or whatever the case is about a public policy issue. And let's tell their stories and really try to make the case for why change should or shouldn't happen.
Talk a little bit about your own background. You came to this from the Arizona Capital Times?
Yeah, I did, which is the ultimate of those insidery kind of take on government, right? You know, it's a Capital Times is a great paper. I was there for more than a dozen years. Started as a reporter, worked my way up and left there. When I left, I was editor of the entire editorial operations there. And, you know, it is quintessentially an insidery publication. It is aimed at lobbyists and government officials and bureaucrats and politicians and elected officials and folks who are already really highly, highly engaged in the political process. And I think there is a huge place for that. That is important work that gets done. I mean, having a journalistic organ that speaks to the people, directly to the people who are in control is really important. But I think it's also, you know, vitally important to the health of our community and the health of our democracy to have news that really is aimed at regular people, at the people who have so much else going on in their lives that they don't have time to be bothered with politics. And politics is gross and yucky and it's off-putting and it's all of those things a lot of the time. But it's also really important. There are moments in government and in politics that really do affect people's lives and that can change the course of a community. And those are the things that we want to talk about and we want to write about and we want to cover, and we really want to try to put that human face, that face of the average Arizonan, whether they're in Tucson or they're in Phoenix or they're in Flagstaff or they're in Snowflake. You know, we want to write those stories that really explain why it's important what your government does and why you as a citizen and as a, you know, an engaged member of your community, why you should care.
Impeachment is the topic of the week, and we are taping this on Thursday, and it won't air till Sunday. So a lot could change between now and then. Things seem to be moving fast in Washington. But at this point, the only Democrat in our House delegation who has not signed on to an impeachment inquiry is Representative Tom O'Halloran, who represents the very large District 1, that is one of Arizona's most competitive congressional districts, a district that went for Trump in 2016. But Democrats have held it throughout this decade. You were in an editorial, you were critical of O'Halloran for not stepping up and calling for impeachment.
Yeah, you know, I think it's notable that he is the only Democrat here. You know, I mean, he is, you know, he's not the only moderate Democrat. I mean, I think you've got folks like, you know, Greg Stanton is certainly, I think, to the left of Tom O'Halloran, but he, you know, he's by no means, you know, a member of the Progressive Caucus or anything like that. You know, he represents a, you know, a swingy district in central Phoenix. And, you know, he's an attorney. He comes from a law enforcement prosecutorial background, as does Tom O'Halloran. Tom O'Halloran is a former police officer, a former undercover cop in Chicago. You know,
and Kirkpatrick down here in Southern Arizona has a similar background.
Exactly. Another, you know, legal background, someone who, again, is in a district, you know, is someone who I don't think anyone would say in good faith that, you know, Ann Kirkpatrick is, you know, the left of the left or anything. I mean, she represents a district that is, you know, leans slightly left. And I think she generally takes pretty temperate, moderate stances on a lot of issues that are important to voters. And she came out several months ago and said, look, this is a bridge too far. We've seen enough. It's time to move forward with an impeachment inquiry. Tom O'Halloran has resisted doing that. And not only has he resisted doing it up to this point, but he's resisted doing it with everything we've learned in the last week, a week-ish, week and a half, about this Ukraine issue, which was a catalyst on Monday for, I don't know, some three or four dozen members of the Democratic caucus who were in the same boat as Tom O'Halloran to say, you know what, that's enough. We can no longer abide this. This is such an egregious and flagrant abuse of power by the president that we have no choice but to move forward to do our constitutional duty and to begin impeachment proceedings. Tom O'Halloran released a statement that I think my reaction when it came out was, well, Tom O'Halloran just said a lot of nothing. It was basically something along the lines of, we need to look into things, we need to do a full investigation, we need to find out the facts, you know, and I look forward to doing that. That's all well and good. And the couple problems I see with that. One is that the impeachment inquiry is really kind of designed to do that, right? It's designed to do an investigation, to gather all these facts, all this information, with a specific purpose of determining whether articles of impeachment are necessary, whether high crimes and misdemeanors have been committed. Secondly, you know, House Democrats have been investigating President Trump. They have six committees that are investigating President Trump and have been doing so since January when Democrats took the majority. They've had a very difficult time getting anything done because the Trump administration has stonewalled them at just about every step of the way. They've just what we know about this Ukraine thing is the amount of stonewalling is unbelievable. That this whistleblower complaint by federal law was supposed to be turned over to Congress. The White House blocked it, held it up, eventually under pressure released it after a unanimous vote of the U.S. Senate was forced to release it. And then they released the quote-unquote transcript, this kind of more or less amounts to kind of a notebook of the phone call. And, you know, we've learned in the whistleblower complaint since, as after that was made public, that the White House apparently took some really extraordinary steps to hide information about this phone call and about what was discussed, even within the government, and hide it from people who ought to have had access to it. They put it on a special secure server that is only for the highest of highly classified information to keep it away from people. And, you know, I think all of those are indicative of the kinds of cover-up and the kinds of stonewalling and refusal to be held accountable that it takes something like an impeachment to really shake that loose. That provides a very large legal justification, an ability for Democrats to get some of the things that they need. And, you know, for Tom O'Halloran to say out of one side of his mouth, we need an investigation, but out of the other side of his mouth, be completely silent on impeachment and tacitly be opposed to it. You know, I think it really does make me wonder at this point, what would it take for Tom O'Halloran to look around and say, okay, it's time for impeachment. With all we've seen so far, I struggle to think of what it would take.
If you're just tuning in, I'm Jim Nintzel, your host for Zona Politics, and we are talking with Jim Small, the editor of the Arizona Mirror, a online news agency that is celebrating its first anniversary. And O'Halloran, obviously looking to be a very moderate Democrat. We see that also with our freshman senator, Kyrsten Sinema, and she's certainly making progressive Democrats unhappy by voting alongside Republicans on some issues. They're actually looking to censure her, but that's been shut down until January. Can you talk a little bit about what's happening there?
Yeah, so progressives in the Arizona Democratic Party have been increasingly disappointed with Kyrsten Sinema over the first 9 months of the year. And, you know, in particular, there's a couple of things that are really, I think, have gotten under their skin. She supported several Trump nominees to cabinet posts, including Attorney General William Barr, who is neck deep in this entire Ukraine strong arming Joe Biden impeachment fiasco, and as well as David Bernhardt, the director of the Department of Interior. You know, and those were people who, you know, I think a lot of Democrats saw as nominees who were unqualified or who were people who shouldn't be at that station in government. Senator Sinema went along with them. She supported them. She also is the only Democrat, I think, or maybe one of two Democrats who has refused to sign on to legislation that would basically restore net neutrality rules and protect freedoms on the internet and take powers away from the ISPs that we all pay every month for our increasingly slow and spotty service. And so they have quietly mounted some protests throughout the year. It kind of culminated earlier in the month with an attempt to censure her, to have a formal censure of her at the Democratic Party's state meeting in Prescott. That resolution that they had was tabled. Basically, it was determined to be out of order. There was some kind of drafting error with it. And so they're going to have a chance to come back in January and see if they can try again. It would certainly be a huge embarrassment for Kyrsten Sinema to even have this fight at all, let alone have this passed by the state Democratic Party. So my guess is they'll find some way to keep this. I would imagine that they're working overtime to try to keep this thing off the floor. Senator Sinema doesn't want this. The Democratic Party doesn't want this. But the progressives are, you know, increasingly upset with her. And I think that they want to make their feelings known.
Let's shift gears over to sex ed. We have had our own controversy over Tucson Unified School District's efforts to update its sex ed materials. But this is really developing into a statewide issue with some very hard words about efforts around the state coming from the Speaker of the House, Rusty Bowers, and some other lawmakers. Can you unpack what's going on here for us?
Yeah, I mean, I do feel like it's weird. You know, I've lived in the state my whole life, but I feel like we've had this fight over sex ed like every 15 or 20 years. But we're at it again. And essentially, the fight comes down to what should children be taught in schools? What is appropriate for the government, in this case, in the form of a school, to teach children? And you know, what should be left solely up to the parents? And, you know, the fight right now is not over should sex ed exist. It's over what should the focus of the sex ed be and what should the kind of the content of what's taught be. And, you know, it's this idea of what's called comprehensive sex education, which is basically medically accurate education materials and age appropriate. So the things that you teach a child who's six is different than what you teach a child who's 11 than what you teach a child who's 14. Because they have different emotional maturities and physical maturities, you know, so and what do they need to know about things like consent as a general rule versus consent in a, you know, in a sexual situation versus, you know, what is a healthy relationship? What does abuse look like? What do, you know, all these different things that go into healthy interpersonal relationships. And that's what the focus of this comprehensive sex ed really is kind of building to that over the course of a child's academic career.
And it seems like in Tucson, at least, there's also an emphasis on tolerance towards people who are different, people who may be gay or lesbian or transsexual or what have you.
Correct. And that's, you know, that is the other component of it, is it's an acceptance. It's a recognition that there are people who are different than you and that, you know, not everyone, different strokes for different folks, right? I mean, that everyone is going to have their own way of developing and expressing themselves. And this is terrifying for some groups of conservatives. And you know, a lot of them look at this, all these weird, twisted theories about this whole thing. And you know, the idea that this is planned, Rusty Bowers, the House Speaker, Republican from Mesa, came out at an education forum recently in Gilbert, up in the Phoenix area, and said this is all about Planned Parenthood is trying to push for this comprehensive sex ed so that way they will make the kids open to having sex sooner, so that way they'll get unwanted pregnancies and STDs, so that way Planned Parenthood will make money. I mean, this is like the path they're going down. Other people were talking about how these, you know, teaching kids that it's okay to be gay or that some of your friends might be gay or transgendered or what have you, that is designed to basically turn kids into transgendered people and into gay people. And it's a lot of these are the same ideas that I think that we've had in this fight, you know, over the last several decades, but they're coming back. It's 2019 and we're still talking about, you know, we're talking positively about, you know, homosexuality or LGBTQ issues will that in turn cause children to be gay? I mean, Rusty Bowers went so far as to basically say, kids don't need to be taught anything. If you've ever talked to a kid, they figured out sex by themselves. They don't need our help, which is just like a baffling statement. But, I can't even imagine that. I mean, sure, lots of people have learned about sex by themselves, and lots of people have a lot of bad things to show for it as well. And you know, the consequences of that kind of an attitude, I think, are pretty obvious to most people.
Yeah, you know, I have a six-year-old daughter, and she seems to at least know the differences between penises and vaginas, and she laughs at my vagina all the time, she says. But on a more serious note, this controversy also seems to be heading headlong into recommendations from a governor's committee that's developing ideas on how to protect children from sexual abuse. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on there?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that, you know, my colleague, my reporter, Jared McDonald-DeVoy, has been really following. He's been covering this governor's sex abuse task force. And, you know, their job is to come up with recommendations for the legislature for how do we, what do we need to do to help prevent child sexual abuse going forward and put in place laws and requirements at, you know, various parts of government to help identify and keep this kind of thing from happening. And one of the things that they say is like the bedrock principle is education, and it's educating children about, you know, basically medically accurate, age appropriate education on sexual issues and on, you know, identifying abuse and understanding relationships and power imbalances and things like that. And, you know, they say that prosecutors, law enforcement, mental health professionals, public health professionals all say that this is, you know, kind of like that core principle. You need to start there and then you can build on top of that. And so now you've got folks like Rusty Bowers and Senator Sylvia Allen, a Republican from Snowflake, who are saying that, you know, they're going to look at legislation to ban all sex ed up until fifth grade, which, okay, that's great, but that doesn't really that really puts them at loggerheads with this governor's task force, which is saying we need to start doing this in preschool and kindergarten and start having these discussions with children so that way they're able to learn, you know, who is allowed to touch you, what are your body parts called, what are good touches and bad touches, all these different kinds of things that would be ostensibly outlawed under these legislative proposals that folks like Senator Sylvia Allen are talking about.
And again, if you're just joining us, this is Zona Politics. I'm your host, Jim Nintzel, and we're talking with Jim Small from the AZ Mirror, an online news organization. Check them out at azmirror.com. AZMirror.com. And let's talk a little bit about criminal justice reform and our state prison system. This is something that seemed to have some momentum at the start of the last legislative session, but not too much happened. I think a bill got passed that didn't make criminal justice reform advocates especially happy. Are you likely to see a renewed push for this in January, do you think?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, I think this is, you know, obviously the advocates didn't get what they wanted in January. I'm quite sure that they knew they weren't going to get everything that they wanted in January, that this is, you know, this is something of a middle to long game here. You know, this is going to take several years of work to lay the groundwork to get some of these reforms passed. You know, but they were very disappointed. I think one of the chief disappointments that they had this past year was just how intensely prosecutors lobbied to kill their measures, in particular to veto a bill that was on the governor's desk. Prosecutors in Maricopa County and Yavapai County, Sheila Polk in Yavapai County and now Supreme Court Justice Bill Montgomery in Maricopa, lobbied to kill, you know, a bill that would have reduced sentences for a lot of people. Frankly, lawmakers, the Republican advocates for this bill and some of the folks in the criminal justice reform community felt betrayed. They felt as though they had reached a deal and that those prosecutors were gonna sit on the sidelines, and they didn't. And so Governor Ducey vetoed the bills. There's a lot of kind of speculation now that with Bill Montgomery out of his current role as a prosecutor and now on the bench, that he's going to have a lot less influence, and in particular, that he's not going to be in Doug Ducey's ear about all this stuff. And so that Doug Ducey might be more persuadable. I don't know that that's the case, personally. I tend to think that Doug Ducey is a pretty big boy, and he can make up his own mind, and he doesn't just do what Bill Montgomery tells him. And I think Ducey is just inherently skeptical and wary of doing any criminal justice reform issues. I don't think he's necessarily caught up with the idea that is going through a lot of prosecutors' offices and a lot of scholarly views of the criminal justice system, that it doesn't work and that it is punitive and retributive, and that there are a lot of gains to be made both from a governance perspective, from a budget perspective, and from a societal perspective to doing things like restorative justice.
And you mentioned the prison system, and it seems like our state prisons are going through some troubles of their own, from broken locks to trouble maintaining staffing levels. Why is it so hard to get good help these days?
Mostly because two reasons. One, we keep putting a lot more people into prison, and our prison population has swelled, and we are perennially at or near the top of the per capita incarceration rates in the country. So we do have, without a doubt, when people talk about mass incarceration problems, Arizona is at the leading edge of that. The other problem is that, along with that mass incarceration, you would expect the legislature would fund the system properly to take care of those prisoners and to, you know, keep the guards safe and keep the prisons maintained. And they just haven't done that. Prison wages for corrections officers last year went up 10%. But before that, I think that it's been like a decade since they've been increased. You know, they've had a hard time filling vacancies. Vacancy rates have skyrocketed. What ends up happening in a lot of cases is folks who want to work in the law enforcement agencies get a job with the Department of Corrections, get trained, work there for a couple of years, get some experience, and then go apply to a county sheriff's office or to the FBI or to a municipal police department or to a private prison company even, and go make a lot more money. And they've already been trained and they've already got some experience, so they can come in, you know, not at a starting salary, but, you know, at a salary commensurate with, you know, someone who's got 2 or 3 years under their belt. And that just, you know, really deepens the problem at DOC. Right now, they've got more than 19% of all prison guard correction officers' jobs are vacant right now.
So 1 out of 5.
1 out of 5. That doesn't mean they get rid of 1 out of 5 prisoners, right? I mean, they've still got the same 42,000 or so prisoners that are there, whether they've got, you know, whether all the corrections officers are there or only 80% are there. And so what ends up happening is they have to work a lot of overtime. Earlier this year, the crisis got so bad, they actually had to increase the cap on overtime that each employee could work. They increased it from 24 hours a week, which is still a really high cap, to 32 hours a week. That means they've essentially got people who are able to work more than 70 hours a week as corrections officers. You know, that is not a sustainable situation.
I wouldn't think it would keep you on your toes in what is a very dangerous, can be a very dangerous situation.
Absolutely. And you know, that... It was a focus of discussion at a legislative panel hearing yesterday. You know, they were talking to the Department of Corrections about these vacancies, and the agency has identified they've got a plan in place. They want to cut the vacancy rate from 19% to about 6%, basically cutting it by about 2/3. And they want to do that within the next year. And in order to do that, they need to basically have a net hiring of about 203 corrections officers every quarter. So they need to bring in 203, and, you know, with the expected losses and promotions and things like that, they need to be at a plus 203. Right now, they're at a negative 74. I mean, they are going, not only are they not meeting their goals, but they're actually getting worse, which, you know, in turn does make the prisons more dangerous. It makes it more dangerous for the corrections officers and the other staff that's in there. And it also makes it more dangerous for the prisoners, frankly.
And we are just about out of time. I wanted to ask you about some of these water issues in Pinal County, but I'll just encourage folks to go to azmirror.com and read those stories, because I think they're very important. That, of course, is the county between Pima County and Maricopa County, between you and me at this point, and fast-growing county. But we'll let folks read about that, because I definitely wanted to ask you about Trump stock coming up in Lake Havasu City. Tell us a little bit about Trump stock.
Trump stock is going to be a 3-day festival of all things Trump. It is going to be, yeah, I don't know. It's going to feature Republican elected officials, musicians who sing Trump themed and MAGA themed songs, QAnon supporters, some musicians, frankly, who sing songs about QAnon. And it's going to have a bunch of Republican elected officials at it too, and some extremists. You know, some of the border vigilante groups and the right wing extremist groups are going to be there. And you know, they are asking people to pay money to basically get into a 3-day event, camp out in Lake Havasu City, and enjoy, I don't know, 72 hours of all things Trump.
It sounds like the South by Southwest of Trump world.
I think it sounds more like the Fire Festival of Trump world, if
yes,
you ask me.
Well,
but that
could
is,
well be.
You know, that's a matter of perspective, I'm sure.
That's coming up in, January of next year?
Which one?
The Trump stock.
Oh, no, that's coming up in a week? Yeah.
What? Is it coming up that soon?
October 4th.
October 4th. Holy cow. Yeah. All right. Hey, we've been talking with Jim Small from the AZ Mirror at azmirror.com. Lots of great information about what's going on in state politics and government at that website. 1 year old now. Jim, congratulations on your birthday, and thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on, Jim.
And you've been listening to Zona Politics with Jim Nintzel. We will be back next week. Thank you all for tuning in.
Zona Politics is made possible with the generous support of The Loft Cinema, Tucson's independent movie theater. The Loft features independent, foreign, and documentary films, cult classics, discussions with filmmakers, and much more, including the Loft Film Fest in November. The Loft is located at 3233 East Speedway Boulevard. Showtimes can be found at loftcinema.org. Support for Zona Politics is provided by Hotel Congress in historic downtown Tucson. Hotel Congress is known for its world-famous taproom, Cup Cafe, and Club Congress, offering local and national acts inside and outside on the plaza. More information at hotelcongress.com and 622-8848.